Chapter 4. Growing the Island's Life. The air was still cool when the first farmers stepped into the fields. The sun had only begun to rise above the treetops, but already the canucos, the raised mounds of soil that formed the backbone of Taino agriculture, were dotted with workers. Women bent low to press cassava cuttings into the earth, while men broke new ground with wooden digging sticks tipped with polished stone. Nearby, children carried baskets of seedlings, careful not to damage the delicate roots. In the distance, the scent of smoke drifted from a small fire, where another group was clearing brush for an expansion of the field. The work was rhythmic, almost ceremonial, guided by generations of knowledge about when and where to plant, how to keep the soil fertile, and how to time the harvest to avoid storms. Cassava, the foundation crop. Cassava, or yuca, was more than a staple food. It was the foundation of Taino survival. The plant's roots could be harvested year-round, offering a dependable source of calories in both abundance and scarcity. Yet raw cassava contained toxic compounds that made it dangerous to eat without careful preparation. Processing cassava was an art and a science. Once harvested, the roots were peeled and grated into a fine pulp using tools made from rough stone or coral. The pulp was then placed into a long woven sleeve, called a sibuyukin, which was hung from a beam and twisted to squeeze out the poisonous liquid. The dry pulp was spread thin over a flat clay griddle and baked into round, crisp bread, durable enough to store for months and light enough to carry on long canoe journeys. The mastery of cassava preparation allowed the Taino to feed large populations and store food for trade or emergencies, giving them a stability that mobile hunter-gatherer groups could not match. Other cultivated crops. Though cassava dominated the fields, it was not the only crop the Taino relied on. The canuco system supported a diverse range of plants, each chosen for its nutritional value and compatibility with others. Maize grew alongside beans, which replenished the soil with nitrogen. Sweet potatoes and yams added variety and resilience, while peppers brought flavor and medicinal properties. Cotton was planted for practical use rather than food. Its fibers were spun and woven into hammocks, sashes, fishing nets, and ceremonial garments. Pineapples, guava, and other tropical fruits grew in household gardens, providing fresh sweetness to the diet. Crop diversity was more than convenience. It was insurance. If one crop failed due to pests or weather, others could fill the gap, ensuring the community's survival. Fishing as daily sustenance. Fishing was as central to Taino life as farming, and coastal communities treated the sea as a second field. Nets woven from cotton or palm fibers were used for larger catches, while fish traps made of sticks and reeds were placed in shallow waters. Spears and hooks carved from bone or shell allowed for targeted fishing of specific species. Fishing followed seasonal patterns. Certain times of year brought schools of fish close to shore, while other seasons were better for catching turtles or lobsters. Coastal knowledge was passed down within families, with experienced fishers teaching younger generations where to find the best spots and how to read the color and movement of the water. The role of men and women in food production. Agriculture and fishing required cooperation between genders. Men often handled the heavier labor of clearing land, cutting trees, or paddling canoes to distant fishing grounds. Women managed much of the planting, weeding, and harvesting, as well as processing crops into usable food. This division of labor was not a rigid boundary. Necessity often blurred the lines. In smaller villages, everyone did a little of everything, with skills passed freely between men and women. The goal was efficiency, not exclusion. Managing natural resources. The Taino approach to resource management was rooted in observation and long-term thinking. Fields were rotated to allow the land to rest. Areas rich in certain plants or wildlife were used seasonally, giving nature time to replenish. Fishing grounds were respected in much the same way. Communities understood that overfishing could deplete a resource, so certain species were avoided during breeding seasons. This traditional ecological knowledge ensured that the Taino could sustain themselves without exhausting their environment. Agriculture and ceremony. Planting and harvesting were never purely economic acts. They were bound to the spiritual life of the community. Boheeks performed rituals before the first planting, calling on zimis to bless the crops. At harvest, offerings of cassava, tobacco, or fruit were made in gratitude. These ceremonies reinforced the belief that humans were partners with the natural world, not its masters. Successful farming was seen as a result of harmony with the spirits, careful work, and respect for the land. Trade and surplus. A successful harvest meant more than food security. It meant opportunity. Surplus cassava bread, cotton, or preserved fish could be traded to other villages for goods not produced locally. Canoe expeditions often returned with exotic feathers, specialized tools, or unique shells from distant shores. This trade strengthened political alliances and helped maintain balance between communities with different resources. It also expanded cultural connections, ensuring that ideas and traditions traveled alongside material goods. Tools of the fields and waters. Taino agriculture and fishing depended on tools crafted from the natural resources available on the islands. While they lacked metal, their craftsmanship in stone, shell, bone, and hardwood produced implements that were durable, efficient, and well-suited to their environment. The COA, a long wooden digging stick with a sharpened end hardened by fire, was the primary agricultural tool. Farmers used it to break soil, plant cuttings, and weed around crops. Some versions had stone or shell blades fitted at the tip to increase cutting power. For fishing, nets woven from cotton or palm fibers varied in mesh size depending on the intended catch. Bone or shell hooks were polished smooth to prevent fraying lines. Spears with multiple prongs allowed for greater success in shallow water hunting, while large dugout canoes carried traps to deeper areas. Innovations in the canuco system. The canuco method of raised mound farming was one of the Taino's greatest agricultural innovations. Mounds could be arranged in long rows, allowing efficient planting, irrigation, and harvesting. The elevated design improved drainage in heavy rains and retained warmth, which was especially important during cooler months. This system also supported intercropping, planting multiple species together to make the most of the soil and space. Cassava might be planted alongside beans, which replenished nitrogen, and peppers, which helped deter pests. This reduced the need to abandon or replant fields frequently, allowing for sustained productivity year after year. Water management. While the Caribbean climate provided regular rainfall, water management was still important. Farmers placed fields near natural springs or streams when possible, but they also used shallow ditches to direct water during dry spells. In some areas, stone-lined channels carried water from upland sources to lower fields. These irrigation methods were simple but effective, reflecting an understanding of the land's contours and the flow of seasonal rains. Preservation and storage. Preserving food extended its usefulness and allowed for trade over long distances. Cassava bread, because it was dry and resistant to spoilage, could be stored for months in woven baskets or pottery jars. Fish and meat were preserved through smoking over low fires, a process that added flavor while keeping insects away. Salt, gathered from coastal flats, was also used to cure fish for longer storage. Fruits were eaten fresh when in season, but could be sun-dried to extend availability. Comparisons to other indigenous societies. In the wider Americas, the Taino shared certain agricultural traits with other Arawakan-speaking peoples of South America, particularly in cassava cultivation and processing. However, their combination of large-scale mound farming, diversified cropping, and integration with extensive fishing networks set them apart. In contrast to the maize-dominated agriculture of the Maya or the Inca, the Taino centered their food economy on cassava, a crop uniquely suited to their island environment. Their balanced reliance on both land and sea resources gave them resilience in the face of environmental challenges. The social dimension of food production. Agriculture and fishing were not merely technical skills. They were social activities that reinforced community ties. Large planting days involved multiple households working side by side, followed by shared meals. Fishing expeditions were often communal, with the catch divided among all participating families. Even food preparation had a social component. Women gathered to grate cassava and bake bread together, sharing news, stories, and songs. These gatherings built social cohesion and ensured that everyone stayed informed about events in the wider community. Spiritual protection for crops and catch. Before planting, farmers sometimes placed small offerings, a few grains of maize, a piece of tobacco, or a carved stone, into the soil to invite blessings from the zemis. Fishermen carried charms or amulets into their canoes, believing they would ensure safety and a plentiful catch. These practices tied food production to the spiritual fabric of Taino life. Success in farming or fishing was never attributed solely to human effort. It was seen as a partnership between people, nature, and the spirit world. Seasonal cycles of work and harvest. The Taíno year followed the natural rhythms of the Caribbean's wet and dry seasons. Planting, fishing, and harvesting were all tied to predictable environmental patterns, and success depended on knowing when to act and when to wait. The wet season, roughly from May to November, brought warm rains that encouraged rapid plant growth. This was the time to expand canucos, plant cassava cuttings, and tend gardens heavy with beans, peppers, and sweet potatoes. Families worked together during these months, and villages often coordinated planting schedules to ensure a steady supply of labor for larger communal fields. The dry season, from December to April, was harvest time for many crops, especially cassava, which could be left in the ground until needed. Fishing also intensified in the dry months, as calmer seas made longer voyages safer. This was when surplus food was preserved, smoked, dried, or baked into cassava bread, in preparation for the next wet season. Hurricane awareness and preparedness. The same warm waters that nourished the islands also brought danger in the form of hurricanes. The Taíno understood these storms not only as natural events, but as spiritual forces, often associated with the Zimí Guabanseq, the mistress of winds and chaos. Villages were built with hurricanes in mind. Bohayos, with their low conical roofs, resisted strong winds better than flat structures. Crops were planted in multiple locations so that a single storm would not destroy the entire food supply. Fishing canoes were pulled far inland or lashed securely to trees before a storm's arrival. After hurricanes, recovery efforts were swift. Families pooled resources, shared stored food, and replanted damaged fields as soon as conditions allowed. Managing soil fertility. Even in the fertile Caribbean, soil needed care. The Taíno used shifting cultivation, moving planting areas every few years, to let fields recover. In more permanent canucos, they enriched the soil with ash from burned vegetation, decomposed plant matter, and discarded shells from shellfish harvests. The rotation of crops also helped maintain balance. Legumes such as beans restored nutrients, while root crops loosened the soil for better drainage. This understanding of soil management allowed the same fields to be productive for decades. Fishing seasons and techniques. Fishing followed its own calendar. In certain months, large schools of fish moved close to shore, making net fishing highly productive. During turtle nesting season, coastal communities gathered eggs and meat in moderation, ensuring enough were left to sustain the population. Fishing trips could last from sunrise until midday or extend overnight, depending on the target species. At night, torches were used to attract fish to the surface, where they could be speared or netted more easily. The role of festivals in agricultural and fishing cycles. Seasonal festivals marked the transitions in the agricultural and fishing year. Planting festivals honored the Zimis who governed fertility, while harvest celebrations expressed gratitude for abundance. Fishing communities also held rituals before the start of peak seasons, seeking protection for those who ventured far into open waters. These events combined ceremony, music, dance, and feasting, reinforcing the idea that survival was a communal achievement, not an individual one. Environmental challenges beyond hurricanes. Droughts could pose serious threats, especially on smaller islands like Jamaica, where fresh water was more limited. During extended dry periods, communities relied heavily on stored cassava bread and preserved fish. Springs and streams were guarded carefully, and water use was restricted to essentials. Pests also challenged food production. Birds, insects, and rodents could damage crops if not managed. Families used practical deterrents. Scarecrows made from palm fronds, elevated storage platforms, and the planting of certain aromatic plants to repel insects. Adapting through mobility and trade. When environmental challenges overwhelmed local resources, the Taíno relied on their trade networks to fill the gap. Villages with surplus could supply those in need, knowing that the favor might one day be returned. This mutual support reduced the risk of famine and kept political alliances strong. Some households even maintained seasonal residences, fishing huts along the coast for part of the year and inland farming plots for the rest, maximizing access to different resources at different times. Food as the center of social life. In Taíno society, food was never just a necessity. It was a point of connection. Meals were social events, whether shared among a family in their bohayo or prepared for an entire village during festivals. The act of eating together reinforced relationships, built trust, and reminded people that survival was a collective achievement. Large harvests were occasions for feasting. Families brought baskets of cassava bread, roasted meat, and fresh fruits to the plaza. These gatherings were filled with music, dance, and storytelling, turning abundance into celebration. Even the division of food reflected social bonds. The cacique received the first portion, not as a show of privilege, but as a symbol of leadership and gratitude for guidance. Agriculture as a political tool. Control over food resources was also a form of political power. A cacique who could ensure consistent harvests and manage surplus effectively gained prestige and loyalty. When shortages occurred in one area, leaders who could send aid strengthened their alliances and reinforced their status. Tribute in the form of agricultural products was central to diplomacy. Cassava bread, smoked fish, or cotton goods were often sent as gifts to other villages, serving both as sustenance and as a message of goodwill. Fishing communities and identity. For coastal villages, fishing was more than an economic activity. It shaped identity. The skills of reading tides, navigating reefs, and crafting nets were passed down like family heirlooms. Certain families became known for their expertise, their reputation adding to the village's prestige in trade and diplomacy. Fishing trips could also be communal bonding experiences. Entire groups might travel together, share catches, and return with stories that would be told for years. This shared labor and reward deepened the sense of belonging within the community. Cultural expression through agriculture and fishing. Farming and fishing were embedded in Taino cultural expression. Carvings on agricultural tools carried symbolic patterns, while fishing canoes were sometimes decorated with paint or carvings invoking protection and good fortune. Songs sung while planting or paddling were more than work chants. They were cultural archives, preserving history and reinforcing identity through repetition. Spiritual significance of sustenance. The Taino believed that the success of their crops and catches depended on maintaining balance with the spiritual world. Before planting, offerings were made to zimis, asking for fertility and protection. Before long voyages, fishermen offered smoke from burning tobacco leaves to the sea, a gesture of respect and request for safe return. This constant blending of the practical and the spiritual ensured that food production was never seen as purely physical labor. It was an act of harmony, gratitude, and cooperation with forces beyond the human world. Legacy of Taino foodways. Many of the foods and practices central to Taino life survived beyond their political autonomy, influencing Caribbean culture for centuries. Cassava bread remains a staple in parts of the region, and techniques for smoking and preserving fish are still used today. Words like canoe, barbecue, and hammock entered global languages through the Taino, along with agricultural knowledge that shaped colonial and modern economies. Their approach to sustainable resource management, community-based production, and the blending of work with cultural identity stands as a model of resilience in a fragile environment. Chapter 5: Tools, Craft, and Trade. Opening scene: the artisan's bench. In the shade of a palm-thatched shelter, an artisan sat cross-legged, a half-finished duho, a carved wooden ceremonial stool, resting across his knees. With each stroke of a polished shell chisel, the smooth contours took shape, revealing the face of a zimi on the front panel. Nearby, another craftsman worked a piece of greenstone into a celt, its edge sharp enough to cut hardwood, yet smooth enough to shine in the light. Around them, baskets of shell beads, cotton thread, and carved ornaments waited to be traded or stored. These were not idle creations. Each piece carried cultural meaning, reflected skill honed over generations, and often held economic and political value far beyond its immediate use. Materials and their sources. The Taino used what their islands provided. Hardwoods like mahogany and ceiba for tools and canoes, limestone and greenstone for grinding and cutting, conch and whelk shells for carving, and cotton for weaving. Some materials came from distant shores through trade, their rarity adding to their prestige. Bone from animals and humans was shaped into needles, awls, and decorative pendants. Coral served as an abrasive for smoothing wood, and plant fibers were twisted into ropes and fishing lines. The gathering of raw materials was itself a skilled task. Woodcutters knew which trees to fell for strength and which to use for lightness, such as ceiba for canoes. Shells were chosen for color, thickness, and workability. Stones suitable for tools often came from specific inland quarries known only to certain families. Stone tools and implements. Even without metal, Taino stone tools were efficient and durable. The celt, a polished axe head made from hard greenstone, was used for clearing land, shaping wood, and building. Grinding stones processed maize and other crops into flour or paste. Stone was also shaped into pestles for mashing roots and seeds, mortars for preparing herbal medicines, and decorative pendants carved with intricate designs. Many of these items had both practical and ceremonial uses, blurring the line between tool and sacred object. Woodcraft and carving. Woodworking was central to Taino life. Canoes, dug from single tree trunks, could reach lengths of over 60 feet and carry dozens of people. Smaller canoes were used for fishing or short trips between nearby villages. The duho, a low ceremonial stool carved from hardwood, symbolized authority and was often reserved for the cacique or other high-ranking individuals. Some duhos were plain, while others were elaborately decorated with inlays of shell or bone, their surfaces polished to a deep shine. Zimi figures, representing gods or ancestral spirits, were carved from wood as well as stone. These could be small enough to carry or large enough to stand in public plazas. The skill of the carver was judged not only by accuracy of form, but by the ability to capture the spiritual essence of the subject. Textiles and weaving. Cotton cultivation supported a robust weaving tradition. Women spun cotton into thread using simple spindles, then wove it into cloth for clothing, hammocks, and fishing nets. Hammocks, in particular, were a Taino innovation that would spread globally after European contact. Cotton sashes, belts, and headbands were often dyed with natural pigments and patterned with designs that indicated clan identity or social status. Weaving skills were passed from mother to daughter, and certain patterns were closely guarded family knowledge. Ceramics and pottery. Pottery served both everyday and ceremonial purposes. Clay was shaped into cooking pots, water jars, and griddles for baking cassava bread. Decorative vessels featured incised patterns, painted designs, or modeled figures. Some pottery was made for trade, with designs adapted to appeal to neighboring communities. Large storage jars kept surplus crops safe from pests, while smaller vessels held medicines, pigments, or offerings for zimis. Ornaments and adornment. Shells, bones, and stones were fashioned into necklaces, earrings, and pendants. These ornaments were worn daily but took on greater significance in ceremonies, when additional decorations signaled rank or spiritual role. Certain shells were valued for their color: pink queen conch, orange tulip shells, and white cowries. Beads could be strung in elaborate patterns, sometimes combined with carved wooden pieces or seeds polished to a glossy finish. Trade networks across the islands. The production of these goods fed into an extensive trade network. Canoes carried pottery, cotton cloth, carved zimis, and shell ornaments between islands. In return, traders brought materials not available locally. Specific types of stone, hardwoods, feathers from tropical birds, or unique shells from distant reefs. Trade was as much about relationships as it was about goods. Exchanges were accompanied by feasts, dances, and gift-giving, strengthening political alliances and ensuring safe passage for future voyages. Specialists and the organization of craft production. While most Taino people could produce basic tools, clothing, or pottery for their own use, certain individuals devoted themselves to full-time craftsmanship. These specialists were often supported by the community, receiving food, materials, or labor in exchange for their work. Artisans could be attached to the household of a cacique, where they produced ceremonial objects, luxury items, and goods intended for trade. Others worked independently, known for their skill in a particular medium, whether wood carving, weaving, or shell ornamentation. The most accomplished artisans were not only valued for the beauty of their work, but for the cultural and political connections their creations could secure. A finely carved zimi gifted to another leader could reinforce an alliance as effectively as a diplomatic agreement. Centers of production. Certain villages became known for specific crafts. A coastal settlement might be renowned for its shell ornaments, while an inland community could produce exceptional pottery or stone tools. This specialization made inter-island trade more dynamic, as each region offered something distinctive. Craft production was often a family affair. Skills were passed from parent to child, and techniques were refined over generations. The tools of the trade, chisels, scrapers, looms, were kept with care, sometimes passed down as heirlooms. Ceremonial versus practical goods. The line between practical and ceremonial goods was often blurred. A canoe, while functional, might be painted with symbolic patterns that invoke protection from the sea. A cassava griddle could be decorated with designs honoring the Zemi associated with fertility and abundance. Objects made specifically for ritual use were often more elaborate, with higher quality materials and intricate designs. These might include ceremonial belts, duhos, or finely carved masks used in dances and religious rites. Trade as a political instrument. Trade in Taino society was never a purely economic act. It was deeply tied to diplomacy and social cohesion. When a canoe arrived in another village's harbor, it brought more than goods. It carried messages, news, and invitations to strengthen ties. Gift exchange was a key part of trade. Even when goods were exchanged for practical purposes, formal presentation and reciprocal generosity were expected. A visiting delegation might present a bundle of cotton cloth, only to be welcomed with a feast and sent home with pottery, shell ornaments, and preserved fish. Goods in motion. What was traded? Common exports from the Taino Islands included cassava bread and other preserved foods, cotton cloth, hammocks and fishing nets, carved wooden zimis and duhos, stone tools and celts, shell and bone ornaments. Common imports included exotic feathers from tropical birds not native to the region, certain stones for tool making, unavailable on some islands, unique shells from distant reefs, hardwood varieties found only in specific areas, medicinal plants and rare pigments. Routes and navigation in trade. Trade routes followed both short coastal paths and long open sea crossings. Skilled navigators relied on the position of the sun and stars, the direction of ocean swells, and the behavior of seabirds to find their way. Voyages were planned according to the season, avoiding peak storm months. Canoes traveled in groups for safety and mutual support, especially on longer journeys between major islands. Each trip was an opportunity for not just commerce, but the renewal of friendships and alliances. Impact on political power. Control of trade routes and access to valuable goods could enhance a cacique's influence. Leaders who managed to secure exclusive sources of certain materials, such as prized greenstone or rare shells, could leverage these in diplomacy, rewarding allies or withholding them from rivals. In this way, trade was as much about reputation as it was about material wealth. A leader known for generosity in trade would draw more partners, while one known for withholding could find themselves isolated. The ceremonial life of artisans. Artisans in Taino society did not see their work as separate from the spiritual life of the community. The act of crafting, whether carving a zimi, shaping a duho, or weaving a ceremonial sash, was itself a form of devotion. Materials were often prepared with ritual care. Wood for a zimi might be taken only from a tree selected by a bohique, after prayers and offerings had been made. The artisan's bench was sometimes considered a sacred space, with tools stored in a particular order and certain tasks performed only at specific times of day or in certain phases of the moon. For important commissions, such as a gift for another cacique or the creation of a community's principal zimi, the artisan might observe fasting or abstain from certain foods to maintain spiritual purity during the work. Trade goods in ritual contexts. Many of the items traded between islands found their way into ceremonies. Shell necklaces could be worn by dancers during religious festivals. Cotton belts might be used to adorn zimis or to wrap offerings. A carved wooden stool could serve as the seat of a cacique during public gatherings, lending symbolic weight to their words. Trade goods also played a role in sealing agreements. When two villages concluded a treaty or alliance, the exchange of crafted objects formalized the relationship. These items often held more than material value. They became physical symbols of trust and obligation. Symbolism in everyday objects. In Taino culture, functional items frequently carried symbolic meaning. A cassava griddle might bear etched lines representing the sun's rays, linking the life-giving crop to the cosmic order. Fishing nets could be knotted in patterns believed to attract good fortune or ward off misfortune. Even mundane tools like pestles or digging sticks could be decorated with geometric designs or stylized figures. These embellishments were not purely decorative. They were reminders that work itself was connected to the spiritual and cultural identity of the community. Artisans as cultural carriers. because artisans traveled to trade their goods, they were also carriers of ideas. Designs, techniques, and even stories could move from one island to another through their journeys. An artisan from Hispaniola might return from Puerto Rico with a new weaving pattern or a carving style that would slowly spread through their home community. This exchange of techniques enriched the cultural diversity of the Taino world while reinforcing a shared visual language across the islands. Certain motifs, such as spirals, zigzags, and animal figures, could be recognized anywhere in the Greater Antilles, even as local variations added unique flair. The role of craft in status and identity. Owning finely made objects could signal social standing. While basic tools and ornaments were available to everyone, elaborate pieces made from rare materials were often reserved for caciques, Natainos, or bohiques. A finely carved zimi might mark a household as influential, while a hammock woven from exceptionally soft cotton could indicate wealth or prestige. At the same time, possession of such goods carried responsibilities. High-ranking individuals were expected to display generosity, lending or gifting items for ceremonies, or using them in ways that benefited the whole community. Preservation and care of valued objects. Valuable items were treated with care, often stored in special containers or hung high within the bohio to keep them safe from damage. Zimis, in particular, might be wrapped in cotton cloth, placed in a carved wooden box, or kept in a designated shrine. Some objects were considered so important that their histories were remembered and retold. A duho used by generations of leaders might be said to carry the wisdom of those who had sat upon it, becoming an heirloom passed down with ceremony and reverence. Trade as a force for inter-island unity. The Taino world stretched across hundreds of miles of open sea, yet their trade networks held the islands together in a web of mutual dependence. Canoes moved steadily along established routes, linking Hispaniola, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and Jamaica to the smaller islands of the Lesser Antilles. Every exchange reinforced political and cultural bonds. A village that supplied high-quality pottery to a coastal ally might receive cotton cloth or preserved fish in return. Over time, these relationships deepened into alliances, sometimes sealed through marriage between prominent families. This unity was practical, ensuring that no single community was left without resources during a poor harvest or after a storm. But it was also cultural. Shared goods carried shared meanings, keeping the islands connected through a common visual and material language. Managing trade over generations. Trade routes and partnerships were not casual arrangements. They were maintained across generations, with knowledge of navigation, safe harbors, and trusted partners passed from elders to younger traders. Some families became known for their role in inter-island exchange. A trader who regularly carried goods between Hispaniola and Puerto Rico might also serve as a messenger, bringing news of political events or ceremonial invitations. This role gave them a unique position as both economic and diplomatic intermediaries. Diplomacy through exchange. Major exchanges were accompanied by formal ceremonies. Arriving traders were welcomed in the plaza with music, dance, and food. The presentation of goods was often public, ensuring transparency and reinforcing the honor of both giver and receiver. Refusing a gift was rare and could be seen as an insult, so even small items were accepted graciously. Reciprocity was essential. A gift today might be answered with an equivalent or greater gift in the future, maintaining balance and respect. Conflict and the flow of goods. While trade generally encouraged peace, disputes could disrupt it. If one community withheld goods promised in a previous exchange, relationships could sour. In extreme cases, this could lead to temporary withdrawal from the trade network or even open hostility. Most of the time, disputes were resolved through negotiation, often mediated by a cacique or an allied village. The goal was always to restore the flow of goods and preserve long-term stability. The enduring legacy of Taino craftsmanship. Even after European contact disrupted Taino political systems, many of their crafts and trade practices survived in adapted forms. Hammocks became common throughout the Caribbean and beyond. Cassava bread remained a dietary staple in many communities. Designs from Taino pottery and carvings influenced later folk art, and certain trade routes continued to be used well into the colonial period. Today, modern Taino descendants and cultural organizations preserve and revive traditional crafts, from weaving cotton belts to carving zimis, as acts of cultural reclamation. These practices not only honor their ancestors, but also maintain a living link to the skills, aesthetics, and values that shaped their world. Chapter 6, Language and Oral Traditions. The air in the reconstructed Taino village in Puerto Rico is still warm from the afternoon sun. Smoke drifts lazily upward from a small clay hearth where a woman tends cassava bread, pressing the thin rounds onto a flat griddle. Children chase each other between the stilted houses, their laughter punctuated by the soft clack of wooden toys. Somewhere beyond the plaza, I hear the deep, steady beat of maracas. The sound is hypnotic, pulling me toward the open space where an elder stands, speaking in a language that once wrapped itself around every tree, river, and mountain of these islands. Her voice is low, deliberate. The syllables are unfamiliar, shaped in a way that seems to draw breath not just from the lungs, but from the earth itself. I don't understand the words, but the rhythm makes my skin prickle. It feels less like speech and more like ceremony. A linguist from the University of Puerto Rico, Dr. Esteban Colon, stands beside me. He leans in and whispers, "What you're hearing is a reconstructed version of classic Taino, based on early Spanish accounts, comparative Arawakan languages, and the living memory of communities in places like Boracan and eastern Cuba." He pauses, watching the elder. The Taino didn't write their language, but they carried it in their mouths, in their songs, and in the names they gave to the land. To know the language is to see the world through their eyes. The sound of the Taino tongue. Taino belongs to the Arawakan language family, which stretched from the Caribbean into parts of South America. Its sounds are gentle, often flowing together like waves. Vowels are open and melodic. Consonants tend toward softness. Dr. Colon explains that Taino phonology relied heavily on a simple set of consonants, B, D, G, H, K, L, M, N, R, S, T, W, Y, and five vowels. It's a language with a musical cadence, he says, and much of that comes from the balance between open vowels and softer consonants. It was meant to be spoken aloud, to be heard in the open air, over the hum of the forest or the roar of the ocean. Certain sounds carried symbolic weight. The gu prefix, for example, often appeared in sacred names, Guabinsex, the fierce goddess of storms, Guajayona, the mythical voyager. The repetition of ka in words could mimic the sound of knocking or cutting, linking language to the physical act it described, naming the world. The Taino named everything around them with precision and poetry. The Caribbean itself holds dozens of place names rooted in their tongue. Jamaica from Zamaca, land of wood and water. Cuba from Cubeo or Coabana, Hispaniola's eastern half still called Quisqueya by many Dominicans. These names weren't arbitrary. They reflected the geography, the resources, or the spiritual essence of a place. I asked Dr. Colon why these names endured when so much else was lost. "Because names are anchors," he replies. "Even when you erase a people, the land keeps speaking their words. Colonizers could build new cities, but rivers and mountains kept their Taino names. It's a quiet resistance. Grammar of a worldview. Unlike European languages that separate past, present, and future rigidly, Taino verbs flowed in aspect more than tense, emphasizing whether an action was ongoing, completed, or habitual, rather than when it happened. This reflected a worldview where cycles mattered more than linear time. Agriculture, seasons, and rituals followed patterns, not fixed dates. The language was also rich in inclusive and exclusive forms of we, distinguishing whether the listener was included. It's a subtle but telling feature. Speech was a tool for defining community boundaries in real time. Words for the sacred. Some words could not be spoken lightly. Semi, for example, referred both to carved idols and to the spirit they embodied. Arido described ceremonial dances that carried history, myth, and law in their steps and lyrics. These were not mere nouns in the Western sense. They were living categories of existence, rooted in belief. Dr. Maria Santiago, an anthropologist who has studied Taino ceremonial life for over two decades, tells me, "When you spoke these words, you invoked the presence of what they named. Language wasn't a label. It was a channel. Oral traditions, memory without paper." Without writing systems, Taino culture relied on oral transmission. Elders were walking archives, entrusted with the stories, genealogies, and spiritual codes of the people. The Arido's communal song dances served as both entertainment and record keeping. Performed in the village plaza, these could last hours or even days, with participants singing, dancing, and acting out episodes from history and myth. One recorded myth, preserved by early Spanish chroniclers, tells of Demian Caracaracol and his brothers, cultural heroes who brought cassava and other gifts to humanity. In the retelling, the story moves in a circular rhythm, key lines repeated in song to ensure they could be remembered across generations. I listen as the elder in the plaza begins such a chant. Her voice rises and falls, accompanied by the steady tap of a hollow drum. Even without understanding the full meaning, I can feel the pull, each repetition etching the story deeper into the collective memory of those listening. Chants, invocations, and power. In Taino thought, words carried force. Ceremonial invocations before planting or fishing were believed to influence the outcome. A bohique, spiritual healer, might chant to call upon the rain spirits or to banish sickness. The choice of words, their order, and even the pauses between them were as important as the physical offerings made. Dr. Santiago explains, when a bohique spoke, it wasn't persuasion in the Western sense. It was participation in the event. If you called for rain properly, you weren't asking. You were helping make it happen. Language under siege. After Columbus's arrival, Taino speech faced rapid decline. Spanish became the language of governance, trade, and survival. Within a few generations, full fluency was rare outside isolated communities. Yet fragments persisted. In households, in fishing villages, in the whispered prayers of those who still called on Atabe, the mother goddess. Some words slipped into Caribbean Spanish, hamaca, hammock, canoa, canoe, barbacoa, barbecue, tabaco, tobacco. Each one carries a ghost of the original pronunciation, a faint echo of voices long silenced. Reconstruction and revival. Today, linguists and cultural activists are piecing together Taino vocabulary and grammar from colonial records, comparative studies with related Arawakan languages, and living memory. Workshops teach basic phrases. Children's books present myths in bilingual form. Musicians blend Taino lyrics into contemporary songs. I meet one such activist, a teacher named Lydia Morales in eastern Cuba. She teaches her students to greet each other with tao, meaning hello or peace, and to name the plants in their school garden with their Taino words. It's not about going back in time, she tells me. It's about remembering we never left. The last song of the plaza. Back in the village plaza, the elders' chant comes to a close. The maracas slow, the drumbeat fades. For a moment, there is only the sound of the wind moving through the palms. Then she steps forward and places a hand on my shoulder. You carry our words now, she says in Spanish, her eyes fixed on mine. They are yours to speak. I leave with the sense that I've been given something fragile and powerful, a thread that connects centuries, continents, and hearts. Ahead lies the next chapter of the Taino story. One written not in stone or ink, but in the resilience of a people whose voice still echoes across the Caribbean.